You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on WJFF.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
Oh, yeah.
The show is Like Mother, Like Son?
Yes. That's right, with
really?
A question mark.
With a question mark.
You know, it's a mother-son thing.
You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio JFF. This is my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
We're in the studio with our producer, Mark Sutton.
All right, our guest today is Isaac Solotaroff, the filmmaker. He's going to talk about his latest film and other projects. Welcome to Like Mother, Like Son, Isaac.
It's good to be on. Thank you.
Isaac, I want to get right to the point about your movie, Visioning Tibet. And it has to do with vision and soul and a medical situation in this incredible country of Tibet. How did you get started and get interested in making this movie?
Well, I did a film in 1999. It was the first film I did called Belief Amended Faith Revealed. And it was about a series of meetings between the Dalai Lama and a group of rabbis and Jewish scholars, which was the basis of a book called The Jew and the Lotus, which was sort of a New Age bestseller in the late 90s. And there was actual footage taken of these meetings between the Dalai Lama and the rabbis. And being my co-producer, Bill Shays, who's also my mentor, thought, you know, there's the possibility of making a film here. And so we ended up making a film about the intersection between Buddhism and Judaism, sort of as presented in these meetings. In the course of doing that, I met Dr. Mark Lieberman, who's an ophthalmologist, and had organized these meetings between the Dalai Lama and the rabbis and Jewish scholars. And he was obviously attended these meetings and was so moved in meeting the Dalai Lama and hearing about the plight of the Tibetan people that he decided to take on this project of curing cataract blindness in Tibet. Tibet has the highest rate of untreated cataract disease in the world, and the Chinese are doing very little to address the issue. And Mark basically goes to Tibet 2 to 3 times a year for a month, 2 months at a time, takes time out of his private practice to do this, and trains Tibetan surgeons to do modern cataract surgery. So it's not the sort of standard missionary model of doing international health care where you sort of lay hands on the people and then go back to the States. He actually is imparting the skills that these doctors in Tibet are now using to cure blindness among their own people. And you know, he started this in 1995, and I met him in 99, and he said, you know, I need a promotional video. I'm trying to raise money. And I said, you know, this is deserving of a one-hour documentary for public television, maybe Discovery Channel. And that's how it started. I mean, I made a trip with him in 2000. I made 200 trips in 2002, 2003. And what I thought would be an 18-month project turned into 4 years, but that's the nature of documentaries. They always take, you know, typically twice as long as you think they will.
Well, I want to hear more about the making of it, but why do the Tibetans have so many cataracts?
Well, there are a number of factors. None are completely, no one is completely sure why it's the case, but the suspicion is that the solar radiation at the higher altitudes, the people living on average above 12,000 to 13,000 feet, will that the eye is more vulnerable to the solar radiation. There's also nutritional factors as well. It's not a particularly well-rounded diet in Tibet, and there's not a whole lot of food to go around. I mean, this really is, I've been to some of the poorest places in the world, and this is as poor as any. And there's maybe a genetic factor as well. But the rate of cataract disease in people over 30 is something like 6 or 7%, which is quite high, and obviously goes up as people get older. So you see people walking in with cataracts at 32 in Tibet, which is unheard of, you know, most other parts of the world.
Are there any theories that the ozone layer depletion has any effect on them, or not really?
Not that I've heard of.
Okay.
So, Isaac, let's step back a second. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up and how you ended up becoming a documentary filmmaker?
Sure. I grew up in New York City, as quickly as the first opportunity I got, I went to school at Vassar, and I basically never came back to New York for about 12, 14 years. I went to college, and then I went out to San Francisco for 10 years, and I taught high school in Oakland for 3 years. And what I found I enjoyed most about I love teaching. I couldn't have been a teacher. I don't really have the discipline and the stamina to do what teachers do. I mean, I think they're the true heroes in the world, and I wasn't up to the task, but I absolutely adore teaching, and what I loved most about it was the storytelling aspect. I was teaching history, and it's something I really enjoyed, trying to make the different concepts, the different units that I was trying to get across, putting them into some sort of narrative. And I remember showing a number of documentaries. Hoop Dreams is one I remember showing to my kids at the one of the years that I was teaching. I thought, you know, that would be the greatest job in the world for me. I love storytelling. I come from a family of writers. My father was a writer. I have two brothers who are writers. And I didn't necessarily want to join the family business of writing, but I wanted to find a way of being able to communicate information, stories, and I found a medium other than writing to do it. I got a job the summer after I finished teaching, apprenticing basically to a filmmaker named Bill Shades, who's the guy I made my first film with, and sort of took it from there. I taught myself everything that I've never taken any classes. I'm pretty much self-taught, a lot of trial and error. A lot of people allowed me to cut my teeth editing their films, and they suffered for it, but I definitely benefited from it, because I made a lot of mistakes along the way, I've been at it for now 7-8 years.
And I assume you're trying to tell, I mean, keep the story structure to a documentary.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, people would like to think that there certainly is a verite nature to documentary filmmaking, that you're basically capturing things as they happen. But truthfully, you can't just depict life as it happens. Otherwise, people will be bored to death.
Right.
Exciting things, you know, you might be shooting an eye camp in Tibet, and we'll roll 20 hours of tape, which I end up maybe pulling 30 seconds from in the final film. I mean, you have to choose selectively, and in that process of choosing what you're going to include in the film, imprinting, or you're putting your imprint of the story on the piece. It's not, you know, you're making editorial decisions and, in a sense, creating a story out of this information. You know, I do think that in making documentaries that you do become a storyteller, even if you're not creating a story out of nothing. I liken it to sculpting. I mean,
right.
it's a huge rock that you're basically chipping away from to form something. But it's still ultimately what you sculpt is something that you've created.
Well, you know, Isaac, it's one of these things where I think almost every kid at some point has the dream or the fantasy that they will be a documentary filmmaker who travels to Tibet and films a PBS, a film that goes on PBS. It's like the ultimate, you know, dream that, you know, every kid pretty much has. And you actually...
That's the coolest thing anyone has ever said to me.
But it's true. I mean,
I
you know,
it is
true. It's like, you know, most of us end up in some 9-to-5 and then have that same dream again when they're 50 and it's too late. But so you actually did it. And tell us about, you know, specifically about the film Visioning Tibet, which is airing on PBS. When is it airing?
In May.
And it is about... this medical problem in Tibet, and the doctors
right.
who have Western doctors who have gone there to figure out what the problem is and how they can solve it, right?
You really have a hero under Mark Lieberman, right?
Say that again?
He's the hero, Mark Lieberman, the doctor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the challenges in making the film as well is that I love Mark and grew to love Mark more as I was making the film. And you have to be careful that you don't want to necessarily fall into the trap of making your protagonist into a hero. I mean, the guy has bad his warts as well.
Right.
And so it was one of the challenges I had in making the film was to make it as balanced as I possibly could. To show that Mark had many sides to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how long is the film?
The film is 56 minutes, which is a standard PBS length. Mm-hmm. And again, it was 56 minutes culled from about 120 hours.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how many hours you filmed. And you said you went to Tibet, I think you said four or five times. How many months did you spend there altogether?
About 4.5 months altogether.
Okay.
I can talk a little bit about the process of making the film. I mean,
I'm interested in that, particularly in Tibet, where you didn't have all of the sort of physical support you would have if you made a film in America.
Absolutely not. No. And to some extent, that's a good thing because people do not have the same suspicions about camera crews in Tibet. Since they've never seen a camera before, they've never seen television. I mean, the places I was shooting, these are certainly places with no electricity or running water. So we show up with these cameras, and one of the features in digital cameras today is that you have these little monitors that you can look at when you're shooting, and then you can turn them 180 degrees so that the subject that you're shooting can see what you're shooting.
Right.
And, I mean, you talk about people having, like, this existential meltdown when they're looking at themselves, on the screen. They've never seen their reflection before unless they were looking into a lake. I mean, there was... To that extent, it made the process easier than if we were shooting somewhere with people a little more media savvy, let's say. But the challenge is, of course, is that we're shooting in a place also where if the people aren't particularly suspicious of foreign crews, the government is. The Chinese government is very concerned about the way in which it's being depicted, especially in Tibet. And so what we basically did is when we would tell people that I was Mark, the doctor who I was following, I was his nephew and my shooter, because it was just a crew of me and the cinematographer. He was my brother, although he's 20 years older than I am and of Germanic descent and looks nothing like me. But we were able to get away with it. And we basically just said that we were making home movies for Dr. Mark.
Oh.
The camera equipment is so small and streamlined at this point that it almost looks like you could be shooting a home movie when you're actually shooting something for television.
Right.
So we benefited from advances in technology, certainly, in making the film.
Got this film, I mean, a documentary, but you also have a production company, right? I mean, you do more
That's
than
right.
just this project. So tell us a little bit about your company and some of the other projects that you're working on.
Sure. Well, the thing about making documentaries is, like I said, I started making this film in 2000 and I finished it in 2005. And now I've had to wait another 18 months for PBS to broadcast it. So that's 6 years between the time I first rolled the camera to when this film is going to actually be on television, 6 years. I mean, you can't make a living just making documentaries. You've got to find other ways to supplement your income. And so I do a host of things. The good paying work that I really enjoy doing is working with music videos. I do what's called VPKs, electronic press kits for music artists. It's basically like a marketing package for music artists. And then I also do corporate video. There are a lot of corporations at this point who are interested in adapting documentary styles in terms of into their marketing pitches. And so I do sort of corporate documentary work. I do commercials. I mean, this is where I probably spend 60-70% of my time doing, and only maybe 30% working on documentaries. But that balance, you know, as I get sort of further along in my career, I'm finding that I'm able to raise more money to do my documentaries, and spend more time working on documentaries than working on sort of more commercial corporate work. But this is a tough road. I mean, there's no question about it. And
how do you raise the money? You like write a proposal?
Well, for Tibet, you know, honestly, guys, that so most of the film was just sweat equity.
Right.
You know, it was me being determined to make this film. I couldn't raise any money for it. And it's one of those things where when you describe it to people, they go, that's nice, but they're not really all that interested. And then when you finish it, they go, that's a great film. It's a great idea. You know, mm-hmm. It's been easy to get money for this. And you're like, no. I mean, people, you kind of have to be able to show people something before they'll get interested and they'll back it. You have to actually show them something that's polished and looks like a film. So in trying to describe this to people and what I was doing, I got no support. So I just had to do it on my own. And I basically locked myself in my editing studio for months at a time and sort of painstakingly went through all this without any money. And
sort of made on a credit card, as it were.
It was in my thank you credits at the end of the film. I thanked American Express,
right,
MasterCard, because I burned through all of them.
Right.
When I was done with the film, I was about $30,000 in debt, and that wasn't stuff that that was basically just necessities that I purchased over the course of the 2 years it took me to edit the film.
Well, the good news on that front is that you're now even with the majority of Americans, and you have a documentary film under your belt. And most people only have the debt, and maybe last year's plasma TV if they're lucky.
This is unfortunately true.
What I'm really sort of always been fascinated about the Tibet thing, because obviously in America, you know, of all of the global causes that we could hear about and get involved in, the marketing machine behind Tibet is probably the most effective after the rainforest. And I don't mean to be totally cynical, but when you've got Bono Sting and the whole crew of Tibetan activists making, and then being completely ineffective also. I mean, I'm sure they've raised $100 billion to save Tibet, and the Chinese aren't budging, it doesn't seem like, on the issue of Tibet. And I'm curious, you having gone there four different times and filmed in Tibet, what that meant as far as, you know, dealing with getting there, first of all, and dealing with what is basically the Chinese authorities. I guess you'd have to go through them at some point. You don't just show up in Tibet, right?
No, that's definitely true. First of all, you know, I would actually make a distinction between the Tibetan causes that are based in Dharamsala, which is where the Dalai Lama is, and those in Tibet, in what's called the Tibet Autonomous Region, what is Tibet. The Tibetan exile community doesn't have any difficulty raising money. The Dalai Lama is this incredible personality and very savvy and an extraordinary fundraiser and networker. And so he has done more to get the word out of the Free Tibet Movement than anyone possibly could. And he's the one that the celebrities, you know, sort of gravitate towards. The people who are ignored are the Tibetans who still live in Tibet, the ones who really are in the most need. And, you know, when Mark was thinking about where he was going to do his work, the Dalai Lama said to him, don't stay here in Dharamsala in the exiled Tibetan communities. Go to Tibet proper. Go to the Tibet Autonomous Region, because that's really where they need the help. I would say that, you know, the Tibet cause certainly gets a lot of attention and philanthropic dollars. But that's not necessarily money that filters down to the Tibetans who need it most.
Now, we were just in China recently, and we understand or hear that the Chinese are hoping to put in dams or tap water out of Tibet for China.
Because that's my mother and father. Unfortunately, they didn't
We were
pay
there.
My way.
I don't know if there was any
talk I saw the pictures.
When you were there or anything about that, they are going to be tapping the water from Tibet for use in China.
Hadn't heard that.
Yeah, okay.
Hadn't heard that. But you know that they're building this rail line, which I think they're just about completing now from Beijing to Lhasa, which will, to Lhasa at this point is 90% ethnic Han Chinese. So only 10% of the capital of Tibet is still ethnic Tibetans, which is pretty extraordinary. And that the number of Chinese in Lhasa is about to explode.
Right.
Because it's just going to be that much easier for them to get there. But I didn't hear anything about water, but I do know that everyone is very concerned that this rail line is going to change the nature and character of Tibet.
And the way I understand it, Isaac, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's such a colossal money loser for China that the only possible incentive they have for building this rail line is to do exactly what you just said, which is to dilute the population.
It is a slow form of genocide. It is genocide by attrition, and they're really adept at it. You know, the truth is that when you get outside of Lhasa and Shigatse, which is one of the other major cities, the outlying areas where most of the Tibetans live is still entirely Tibetan. I mean, the Chinese who are moving to Tibet have no interest in living on dirt farms, you know, at 16,000 feet. So it's not hard to go to Tibet and see the real Tibet, as long as you can get away from your Chinese handlers. I mean, if you go to Tibet as a tourist, you're going to be assigned, you know, a Chinese official or just someone with the tourism agencies who is going to take you around everywhere and look and make sure and really keep close tabs on you. We were very fortunate because Mark is there at the invitation of the Chinese government and simply allowed us to travel freely within Tibet, which is something that's pretty unusual for a Westerner to do.
Is there much tourism there now?
This is the truly ironic thing. By far, the largest number of tourists in Tibet are Chinese.
And the railroad will bring even more.
That's right. And they look at Tibet the way that people probably looked at the Wild West, you know, 100 years ago. I mean, it is the last frontier as far as the Chinese are concerned of China. And the Tibetans are very exotic to them. And they go there like it's Disneyland.
Right.
And so that's really the tourist that you see the most of. But, you know, Tibet's been open to tourists now for probably 10, 15 years. And it's, you know, it's quite expensive to get there, and you can be sure that you're paying three or four times what you should for everything. But I can't more highly recommend a trip than making a trip to Tibet. It is an extraordinary place.
In watching this film, I've been, you know, the privilege of being able to see it before it airs on PBS in May. It is a beautiful film, and what strikes me is that, I mean, you have the benefit of what clearly is a very beautiful place. So the footage itself is dynamic and colorful in a way that, you know, the streets of Manhattan sometimes aren't. But also, it's clear that, you know, as a filmographer, your technique really brings out that beauty and color. And I'm curious what your technique is. I think you alluded to using a digital camera.
That's correct.
So tell us a little bit just about your style. How does it work? You have a digital camera?
But, you know, when it comes to the cinematography in the film, all the credit goes to my cinematographer, Kirk Schroeder, who's a master. The thing that I sort of pride myself on, and Kirk taught me a lot about this, is squeezing the most out of small production budgets and small production packages. So we're basically shooting on a $3,000 camera, and I'm not particularly technical when it comes to the settings one uses on a camera and how you choose the shots that he chose, and, you know, he just gave me beautiful stuff to work with when I edited the film.
But you went with him and were there for the shots, right? And directing it, yeah.
But really the landscape stuff that's in the film that I think really makes it.
Yeah, it's really spectacular. The beautiful shots.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely, that's another artist. I mean, you know, I was fortunate to work with a true cinematic artist. And that's not my forte. And you have to know where your strengths and weaknesses lie. And I knew that Kirk, you know, I wasn't going to try to shoot this film myself. I mean, I shot second camera on a bunch of stuff, but...
So you, know, so you basically got 150 hours of video and throw them in your backpack and trek back to New York and stick it all
right.
in some digital editing thingy and just splice it all together until you get the story that you want? Is that how it works?
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, the unromantic way of putting it, that's exactly what I do. Like I said, there are so many, you know, the whole process of making films is about making choices. And the only, you make certain choices when you're actually shooting the piece, but once you have this finite amount of material to work with, it's all about choices.
So, Isaac, this is great. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing the Visioning Tibet on PBS in May. Do we know the actual date of its airing yet?
We don't have an air date yet, but if you go to the website, which is visioningtibet.com, we'll be posting our dates on there.
And Isaac, for the sake of our listeners, will you spell your last name for us once?
Certainly. It's so my first name is Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, and the last name is Solotarov. S is in Sam, O-L-O, T is in Tom, A-R-O. F is in Frank, F is in Frank, and that's also my website, IsaacSolotaroff.com.
So again, go out, you know, watch this movie on PBS. It's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen, and it's a really important
thank you so much, Ramsey. It's very kind of you.
And it's just great to talk with you. Thank you.
Great talking to you guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Isaac. Wonderful to talk to you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Visit us online at www.likemotherlikeson.org and let us know what you think of the show.
Good night.